Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to be talking about some of the Islamic laws hovering around marriage or marriage-related questions, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, what are the duties, what are the religious obligations of a temporary wife? And what about a permanent wife? Is there any difference between the duties and obligations if someone is a permanent wife or a temporary one?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is a great difference between the duties of a temporary wife and those of a permanent wife. Mm-hmm. A temporary wife is not supposed to stay in her husband's house after she, for example, is available for her husband. I would like to put it in other words. Since the husband is not supporting her financially, mm-hmm. and it's not a responsibility of the husband to provide her with food, clothing, and medical expenses, unless stipulated in the marriage contract, then it's not his responsibility to provide her with these things. So it's not necessary for the temporary wife to stay in her husband's house and not to leave her husband's house without his permission. She can leave, but of course she must be available for her husband when upon demand, okay, whenever the husband wants her to be present, she must be present and she must be available, okay?
Yes.
Also the responsibility of the husband is not to provide for her. He has to give her only the mahr, the dowry, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the dowry, it must be given by the husband, otherwise he is going to remain liable and indebted to the mm-hmm. temporary wife.
Yes.
So the duties and responsibilities are few and far between as compared to the permanent wife.
Yes. And the dowry must be or should be given to the wife.
Should be given, yes.
Right after the marriage.
It can be given after the marriage contract or after the expiry of the marriage, the time fixed for the for the temporary marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be given any time, okay? The validity of the marriage does not depend on the dowry,
right?
Okay? It is a kind of debt, a kind of loan, debt paid that has to be repaid. If the husband does not pay the dowry, it does not mean that the marriage had been actually invalid. Okay, the marriage remains valid, but he will be liable to the wife. As far as the permanent marriage is concerned, of course, the wife has two responsibilities to fulfill. One of the responsibilities is that she must not leave her husband's house without prior coordination, without permission, without
husband's consent.
Without her husband's consent. So his permission is a must. Otherwise, she is she's going to be a disobedient wife.
Right.
A recalcitrant wife. A disobedient wife is a wife who is not who does not deserve any kind of maintenance, any kind of support, financial support. So the husband is not supposed to give, to provide for her in terms of food, in terms of clothing, and medical expenses, as long as the wife remains disobedient.
Mm-hmm.
Disobedient means that she disobeys her husband and neglects her husband, goes out without his permission. Okay. This is one of the obligations and duties.
Yes.
And the second duty is that she must submit herself to her husband, surrender herself to her husband for sexual intercourse, and she cannot say no when she is not sick, when she does not have a valid excuse. Okay. So she must be available for her husband whenever there is a need for her to be in bed, for example. So this is a very important obligation, a very important duty which she cannot ignore. Of course, if a woman is, let's say, gets her monthly period, okay,
mm-hmm.
a woman gets her monthly period, it's not necessary for her to be present, to be available, because they cannot have physical intimacy when the woman is menstruating.
Yes.
Because she's not pure. And of course, and as long as she remains in her menstruation, or and as long as she has that period, she can stay away from her husband.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Most of these ritual or religious obligations are kind of mutual, because we are talking about marriage. Marriage is a kind of mutual contract, isn't it?
You are right. Yes. Just as a woman has a wife has certain obligations and duties to fulfill, the husband also has to reciprocate.
Yes,
he has to provide his wife with food, clothing, medical expenses. He has to take care of them. He has to provide them his wife with a place, accommodation.
Islam does not impose only the obligations on the woman.
Yes, of course.
It also talks about or regards the man or requires the man, in fact, to fulfill his duties and obligations toward the woman.
Of course. He has to share the burden of the family.
Yes.
And, of course, it's not the responsibility nor the duty of the wife to do the cleanup, to do the washing up, to do the household chores, mm-hmm. or to even... suckle the child, to breastfeed the child.
Yes.
If a woman starts breastfeeding her child, she can charge her husband for the milk she gives to her own child.
Yes, true.
So we see that, as you said, that the responsibility has to be shared by both parties to the marriage. Mm-hmm. And it's not the responsibility, unlike some people who, because of ignorance, because of a lack of knowledge, think that it is the responsibility of the housewife, to wash the clothes, to cook the cook meals,
yes.
to iron the mm-hmm. her husband's clothes, and to do the cleaning and everything.
Yes.
It's not her duty.
Exactly.
She can refrain from doing all of this.
Okay. Yes.
But morally speaking, morality...
Even cooking is not her duty.
Yeah, of course, not her duty. Morally speaking, it's very important that both parties to the marriage, the husband and the wife, they should cooperate with each other, they should reconcile with each other, and they should do everything they can to save the marriage.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
And so therefore, it's a kind of edifice, a kind of house, a structure. Both the husband and the wife should keep the house running, the family running, and it's not just as a bird cannot fly with one wing, the family cannot also succeed with either the husband working or the wife working. Okay,
yes,
both of them should work together to make it a success.
Yes, and it's good to reiterate our dear audience know it, because we are talking about the Islamic laws, and when we are talking about laws like in their legal entirety, they stipulate something that just to solve some of the or provide solutions to some of the problems. Otherwise, we all know that a marriage, as I said earlier, as you also nicely put, is a kind of mutual understanding and contract.
Yes.
So, and when a marriage is based on a kind of love, then they do it out of their good intentions and good faith. Usually, even if it is not their responsibility, they do it out of favor. To each other.
Good.
So it is not always like this, that they have to do this, they should do that, they should do this, you know?
Yeah.
So it's something that needs to be taken into consideration also.
I think the families need to improve their knowledge of the Quranic teachings, of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, and they should get acquainted with the lives and the biography of the Ahlul Bayt,
mm-hmm.
and see how they lived, okay?
Yes, true.
How, for example, Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha or Lady Zainab Salamullah Alayha sacrificed themselves for their husbands, and they did whatever their husbands need for the comfort of their husbands.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh
Javid.
That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun la ilaha illahum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun.
In the past few years, the United Arab Emirates has been seeking to increase its influence on Lebanese politics and society. Decades ago, the Emiratis launched their Lebanon project by running charities. Today, they're pulling the strings at the highest socio-political levels in the country. In late June, Arabic Post wrote that the UAE security apparatus has been playing a leading role in stirring up recent violence and riots in Lebanon. Quoting from the Lebanese Interior Minister Mohamed Fahmy through an unnamed source, the news outlet continued, "Friendly countries are generous to us, but to be honest, they're suffocating us." Fahmy didn't explicitly mention the country he accused of fomenting sedition, but private sources confirmed to Arabic Post that the accusations were all leveled against Abu Dhabi.
Lebanon is historically a very important location of the world. It's the midpoint region between the East and the West. It has a lot of resources. And plus, it is a very key player on the political, geographical level. So any country, actually, will want to consider having a part in Lebanon, especially if that country is also playing on a large scale with other countries. So I guess that they will consider that Lebanon is a court where they can score different goals over each other.
Meanwhile, sources close to the Hezbollah resistance movement say that they have evidence that proves the Emiratis' involvement in the Beirut events and reveals their support of anti-Hezbollah groups.
Abu Dhabi doesn't actually care a lot for politics, the more it cares for economy, and the more it cares for technological advancement, and the more it cares for its own good. And she knows that all of those things are related for saying no to this key component in Lebanon. So that's why they're very clear with themselves. They know what they're doing. So apparently, saying yes to Hezbollah means they're going to lose a lot on the international level. So why should they do that?
Competing with Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf countries, the UAE has been seeking to expand its presence in Lebanon, first under the cover of charitable activities after the end of the civil war in 1990. Then they supported the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, funded various Islamic societies, mosques, Muslim clerics, and founded medical clinics and schools.
Well, as an activist in human development, and I really love to work in workshops and human development and skills, they're doing a great job, Emirates, they're doing a great job concerning all of those activities. I would just advise them if they would just, you know, not use them for covering other political acts, because they are able to be in Lebanon and do a lot of acts, and we're able to exchange a lot of things with them on the cultural level if they don't have hidden agendas.
Moreover, following the widespread protests in the Arab world in 2011, Abu Dhabi made its decision to stop its financial support of Islamic societies for their close association with the Muslim Brotherhood and other political Islamic currents. According to Watan Serb, the UAE ambassador frequently visited the Grand Mufti of Lebanon and asked them to remove from their positions the clerics and judges affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood and those sympathetic to Arab revolutions, and not to allow them to run for positions in the Supreme Islamic Council or other administrative positions. Moreover, sources from Islamic Group say that a group of Emirati officers have been pressuring the Lebanese authorities to dissolve the group and close their institutions.
Well, actually, because the Muslim Brotherhood and the other parties, they have this ideological way of dealing with things. And I told you, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and you know, it's sometimes they call themselves like the jewel of the West in the East. So they adopted the Western methodology, they adopted the Western way with all its bad and good aspects. I'm not saying everything is bad, but they adopted everything and they went into this way of living and this lifestyle. So, and this is completely against what some Islamic groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood calls for or deal with. There's a huge ideological difference. There's a huge ideological gap between Muslim Brotherhood and such groups and what the leaders at Dubai actually call for, or they aspire for, what they want. So it's very normal to see them not on the same page, and they don't agree on the same terms.
Meanwhile, the current UAE ambassador, Hamad al-Shamsi, has opened extensive communication channels with Lebanese Christian personalities in several regions and provided unlimited support to Beirut Governor Ziad Shabi to help him with his projects, such as the renovation of churches and other Christian facilities in Beirut. The Emiratis have also worked hard to hire Lebanese media outlets to their own benefit by having them promote the role of the UAE in the country. News outlets such as Nida al-Watan are now clearly at the UAE's service in its competition with even the Saudi Kingdom and its adversity with Turkey, which is experiencing a growing popularity in the Western Asian country. By some credible sources, it was Abu Dhabi that foiled in 2017 the Saudi coup attempt against former Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri when the Saudis detained him in Riyadh and forced him to resign. Watan News website has recently revealed the UAE Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed refused his country's participation in the coup plan against Hariri and informed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of this. A few days after Hariri's mysterious resignation, bin Zayed received Hariri in his palace. The move can be interpreted as a bid to undermine Saudi influence in Lebanon, which is now at a low ebb.
At that incident, Saudi Arabia was practicing a huge, vivid form of authority over the first political Sunni position in the Lebanese government, which is the prime minister. So Dubai would be crazy if she went with Saudi Arabia at that point. Dubai would never actually give such open space for Saudi Arabia to play in Lebanon. We said that there's this huge challenge between all the power figures of the world, power countries of the world. So it would be normal for Dubai to say no to that action. That doesn't mean that caring for Lebanon or the prime minister at that time. It means that this is simply against Dubai's best interests in the region.
In 2018, Saad al-Hariri, who was the leader of the Future Movement, promised the Islamic group that they could be part of his alliance in the upcoming parliamentary elections. However, shortly after, Hariri backtracked on his promise and cut off his relations with them. Sources close to the Islamic group say Hariri made the decision under pressure from Abu Dhabi, that's at loggerheads with the group. After the resignation of Saad al-Hariri in January this year, Now there are rumors that the Emiratis are helping his brother rise and return to the country's political arena, just to make sure that they will maintain the equilibrium in Lebanon.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in gharn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. We are carrying on with these programs to shed light on the greatness of this great personality, Imam Khomeini. So, once again, I've got an expert in the studio, Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who's given us our valuable time, an Islamic scholar and researcher in the holy city of Qom, who has been guiding us through the life and times of Imam Khomeini. We spoke in the last program about the background, the holy lineage of the Imam, which is, you know, of great significance because he does come from the Holy Prophet's family, peace be upon them all. And of course, I'd like to say here at this moment that Imam Khomeini, really, as we will go through these programs and discover, he really gave us a glimpse of what our infallible Imams were like, because there's been a huge gap since the time of the great occultation of the 12th Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may God hasten his appearance soon. But we got a little glimpse in the last 30 years or so, something of what the Holy Prophet's family are like, and in terms of their character, their personality, their distinguishing virtues, their scholarship, of course, and their knowledge, you know, is always a cut above the rest. And, you know, he gave us a glimpse of that. But inshallah, God willing, as we go through these programs, we are going to shed light on this in greater depth. So, Sayyid Taqi, salam, and thank you very much again for being on the program and giving us your valuable time.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's great. So, Sayyid Taqi, we got to the stage, as we say, we were also putting in the background so that our listeners could understand that in what context all this was happening. And we got to the point where, you know, there are some interesting events happening around the town of Khomeini. And we were talking about the fact that because of the Qajar dynasty was at its lowest point, you know, really they had no law and order. Things were pretty much at the end of that particular era. And the British, with their machinations and their imperialist agenda, were changing things here in Iran for the worst. And I'll emphasize that. So what was happening in Khomeini at that particular moment in time where, you know, as you mentioned, we were getting to the history of Imam Khomeini's father in the town of Khomeini?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, really, I mean, during that time, between 1985, his birth, and and 1903 of his shahadat, and you say, what? His shahadat? Yes.
Yes, yes, it's martyrdom.
Imam Khomeini's father was martyred.
Martyred, yes, of course.
And that area was raising a revolutionary alim-e-deen, revolutionary scholar.
Absolutely.
This Sayyid Mustafa, as his name was, Sayyid Mustafa al-Khomeini, he was Imam Khomeini's father.
Yes.
As I said, born in 1885.
Yes.
He was sent to study Islamic studies in Isfahan.
In Isfahan.
Isfahan. Yeah. He did his most of his studies in Isfahan. And then after completing certain levels in Isfahan, he made his way to Najaf and Samarra. and then come back to Khomeini.
Right. So because, of course, at that time, Najaf was, you know, the central...
Indeed, that was the hub
the
of...
institution, the central Hawza, you know, of...
Indeed,
of
that was the hub of Islamic education
sure.
and learning.
Sure.
And on acquiring a substantially high quality of studies,
sure.
he returned back to
because,
to
of course,
Khomeini.
In a later program, we'll discuss the fact that, you know, how the Hawza system got established here in the holy city of Qum.
Indeed.
By mm-hmm. Ayatollah Yazdi, of course.
And there were other houses in Iran already. There were certain houses in Mashhad.
Mm-hmm.
There was a house in Iraq. There was
sure.
a house in Isfahan.
Sure.
Qum already had its own breeding point of ulama training.
Sure.
Not as a centralized institution.
Right.
But certainly if we look at a hadith from Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam,
mm-hmm.
which talks about the fact that there will be a time near the Zuhur of the 12th Imam.
That's correct. Yes, that's a very famous
from Najaf would go down into the ground like
like a snake, and
snake
it would re-emerge in Qum.
Exactly, and it would raise his head up in Qum.
Qum.
You're going back to Imam Jafar Sadiq al-Islam's tradition, Imam Muhammad Baqir al-Islam's
but
tradition.
But of course, the Hawza in Qum took on a totally different color, but that's
indeed,
something
but
else.
Indeed, that is that is because of the nature. That is because of the nature of the revolutionized nature of the ulema that we're building around the various... experiences of fatawa given
sure.
by
and we are not digressing by any means, because of course, you know, like the father of Imam Khomeini and Imam Khomeini himself, you know, they took central roles in the establishment of this Hawza system. So that it's even if we are mentioning it now, and of course we'll discuss it in depth in a different program, but it's important to mention that these are all elements into the building up of what we're discussing here.
Indeed, not only just elements, the fact that the nature of the Hawza's operative and how it will later on take on, like Imam Khomeini and others, to guide it, to define its define and maintain its independence from oppressive regimes.
Yes, yes. No, this is very important.
Yeah,
the independence
you have
aspect.
You
of
have
it.
Najaf, which was always independent. From any environment to be able to dictate to it. And you see, that's why you've got Sayyid Mustafa Khomeini in Khomeini, his father, taking on a very strong position, a very hard position against the oppressive Khans who were around there. You know,
that's
because
true.
Of the fact that he was able to maintain that independence of the Ali Medin.
Because,
scholar.
Of course, it has to be mentioned that these oppressive Khans were, you know, at the behest of the corrupt ruling government, were taking lands.
No, they were taking land, but not only that, they were oppressing the people of that
land. Of course, I mean, they were...
And, you know, because of the fact that Imam Khomeini's father was a independent thinking person...
Sure, and resisting against this practice.
Resisting against this practice.
Criminal practice,
and,
yes.
And encouraging people to be resistant, demonstrate their resistance to them.
Yeah.
Yes, it meant in sacrificing life. A lot of people sacrificed their lives in Khomeini in being firmly against these people. They were tortured, they were lame, the bodies, they were injured in various types of injuries that they had to face.
Mm.
And of course, the very fact that the Khans or the oppressive authorities in those areas were looking at the public as if they were their personal servants.
That's right.
That Imam Khomeini's father stood up against that.
Of course.
And the fact that, you know, there were so many others who were fighting amongst themselves as Khans to take up positions in front of the Shah of that time, that they would be even more evil than the last one.
That's right. The brutality was,
you know, the brutality
was
didn't cease.
So
in this process of the brutality that existed, Imam Khomeini's father continuously stood up against these people.
Mm.
And it so happens, I mean, it's really interesting, you know, thing one needs to analyze Imam Khomeini's life in relation to this, because Imam Khomeini, being a younger member of the children of Sayyid Mustafa, he was experiencing things a lot more later on after his father's shahadat.
Yes, yes.
You see, because
after his
father's martyrdom. Because his father was martyred in 1903, and we're using the word martyr. Why? Because you see, Sayyid Mustafa, he was seeing that the Khan of that time was very oppressive, taking up land, doing a lot of atrocities, in killing as well.
There was a violation
people.
Of women's honor there
honor
as
and
well.
Everything. So what he, with a group of people of Khomeini, decided that they would go and visit the provinces head, who himself was a corrupt so-and-so anyway. But the very fact that that type of audience was available just for the sake of demonstrating some type of interaction with the community, that these people on their way to represent Khomeini to the province's governor, that on the way there, the gangster of the time of Khomeini decided that he was going to eliminate them from reaching from before they were able to reach the governor and present them their case.
That's right. This is what is mentioned in the text, isn't it? That it was during his journey from Khomeini to Iraq or on the way back that
on the way there
that this had happened. This awful crime had been committed.
And they shot him and he was killed.
Oh my goodness.
And of course the people of Khomeini did eventually got their reward for
the qasas, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. For what had happened. Mm. But what I'm trying to say that Imam Khomeini was experiencing was in his bodily existence had felt all these things that had happened around him.
Yeah.
But what was really important, I think, which needs to be brought into this context, is that we have hundreds and hundreds of ulema, thousands of ulema probably from 1920 up to now who have
That's
gone through
right.
the Hawza.
I mean, men of great prominence.
You know,
great.
But what made Imam Khomeini Imam Khomeini?
Exactly. That is the question.
That is a very important question. And one of those things which I personally feel is the way Sayyid Mustafa Khomeini felt it necessary to have Imam Khomeini raised in a particular way.
And that's what we want to talk about, because this background is very, very interesting, and it does give us very important lessons in the raising of our own children.
You see,
as
what
well.
I found was something really interesting, and this was when Imam Khomeini was born. His mother could not feed him milk.
Right.
She was, and these are interesting correlating concepts.
Right,
Rasul Akram, when he was born, his mother could
that's
not.
That's right. He was given
to a wet nurse.
A wet nurse.
But then that's interesting, because he was given to a wet nurse. I mean, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala creates his own rationale for people to understand.
Yeah.
But it is a fact that the Jews of Medina knew of the fact that a prophet was going to be born. So
that's
they were always waiting for that time to get their guidance. What was also a difficult thing was that they weren't going to allow the prophet to survive. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created an abnormality where the child would be taken out of the Quraysh's environment, that they would not know where Muhammad was, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Interesting. Very
thus depriving them the audience of him and the fact that they
so
could eliminate.
So even in Imam Khomeini's life, even at a very, very early stage, we're seeing parallels
indeed,
with the history
of
Islam.
The interesting parallel here is the fact that his mother could not. What changed the environment there is that not, God forbid, that his mother was not a spiritual lady, because she was.
No, she was very pious
what happened,
lady, of course.
What happened was that when the child was given to the wet nurse, Imam Khomeini's father said that, look, you'll feed the child, but I will give you the food. I will supply you my own food. So that, you know, on one side he's talking about everything being absolutely halal. From my
own
income.
Right from the beginning.
From my own income. But then what he asked the wet nurse was really interesting. He says, every time you feed the child, I'll give you the food every month, but throughout the month, read a few surahs to the child whilst you're feeding the child.
The surahs from the Quran.
The Quran. When the month finishes and he takes her food, he said, "Did you fulfill that requirement?"
Right.
So the lady says, "Sir, you said that I should do a few surahs whilst I'm feeding the child. During this month, I've read several Qurans in front of this child."
MashaAllah, my goodness, that is amazing.
You know, so this kind of spiritual, from spiritual out, you know, from the outset, he's being spiritually pasted. You know, the milk that the mother's, the wet nurse is giving him is going to him while she's reciting Quran, is listening to Quran whilst, you know, we think sometimes, what's a 2 month, 1 month child going to experience
but
from
the
this?
The other thing is that, you know, it begs the question, did the father have some insight as to, you know, the birth of this particular child? Already he was beginning to see something
no,
about
you see,
this?
What is important, brother, is that if you yourself are a spiritually minded person, you naturally do things which are the consequences of your spirituality.
That is true. That
you're
is
not kind of planning
true.
Anything special.
No, but you're right. It's the complete culture, the complete
and that is
ethos
the culture,
in which
exactly.
he's...
And that was the culture that Sayyid Mustafa was embedded with.
Mm.
And he was passing it on through
onto his son.
His next offspring. Mm. In the same manner, his own son, mm. who was known later on as Ayatollah Pasindide.
Yes,
he wasn't
yes.
anything small.
Yeah, we'll speak about him,
but
of
what
course.
I'm trying
yes.
to bring mm. in this arena mm. is that the spirituality of his father was also passed to him as well.
Yes,
he wasn't
yes.
anything, you know, the leftover of what was trained for Imam Khomeini that
no,
Ayatollah
no.
Pasindide came out of. No,
yes.
he was an entity of his own.
Own.
And he stood firm in his own identity.
Quite. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, his shahadat in 1903.
Mm.
Obviously, Imam Khomeini was only 5 months old.
Five months old at that time.
That
yes,
happened.
Yes, yes.
So you know, it wouldn't have kind of I saw what happened to my father type of thing. Mm. But what was always reminded as an event,
mm.
and that lineage of fighting the oppressed was already embedded in the bloodline,
which comes from the Holy Ahlul Bayt all the time, because this is their martyrdom, their resistance at the of oppressors in their particular period, as we talk about the infallible imams, you know, is a tradition which was going to be followed by this holy family as well.
And in 1918 mm. his mother and his beloved auntie
That's
passed
right.
away because mm-hmm. of cholera.
Yeah.
And at that time Imam Khomeini is only 16.
He's 16 at the time, yes.
And you see again
the parallel that you can draw with Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly.
Prophet
that, you
Muhammad,
know, his,
peace be upon
his,
the loss of Hazrat Khadija and Hazrat Abu Talib.
Well, the very fact that, you know, he's losing relatives who would be of a supportive...
Of central,
exactly.
Yeah, who were central in his upbringing. Yeah.
Exactly. So Imam Khomeini at 18. But then you see that's the demise of his mom and auntie.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as of... I think it from the dates that I have scribbled down, is that from about 1906,
mm-hmm.
When he was about 4 years, 5 years old,
right.
he's already studying Hoza type of courses. He started memorizing the Quran, he's reading the Quran, he's learning various...
Quranic sciences
exactly.
at a very, very early
at a very early age.
Stage.
Sorry, 1908.
1908.
When he was about 6 years old. As
mm-hmm.
of that time, when he was 6 years old,
mm.
he's studying the Quran. He's memorizing the Quran, the recitation of the Quran, various Islamic holy books he becomes familiar with
right.
as time goes on. You know, he and the Persian language.
Of course.
He starts mastering the Persian language and the whole old text of Persian languages.
Yes, yes.
He starts mastering them as time goes on.
Right,
that,
right.
You know, his studies, want for study has already started.
Mm.
He's not playing around, so as to say, and left to listen to the next LP that comes out.
In other words, he's already following the sunnah and the tradition of prophets from before who... You know, you remind me of Prophet Yahya, actually, who was asked at one time to be playing with kids, and he said, I'm not here to play around in life. Life was not created in vain. So, in other words, you know, you're already talking about a very powerful tradition in which, the scholarship is already manifesting itself at a very
Indeed.
Early age.
But then you see, alhamdulillah, when it comes to Islamic learning, you find that he's also learning the tools of life as well. Learning how to ride the horse, he becomes an expert in horse riding.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He becomes expert in using
defensive equipment. He had a great love for sports at
Indeed.
A very early age as well.
And you know, he knew how to defend himself with the weapons of the time.
Yeah,
you know, and
I mean, there's an anecdote or a story associated with that because of, as you pointed out, with the situation with his father, you know, and what Khomeini as a town was going through because of the Khans. Imam Khomeini was very active in his teenage, learning the gun, and of course they were already making what they call the bunkers,
mm-hmm.
by which they were resisting these raids that were coming from these bandits.
Yeah. But you
so
see,
it's
all
interesting.
All the time,
mm-hmm.
certain relatives were reluctant to see him. Maybe he would get killed or something
That's
like that.
True. That's
but
true.
But he would still endeavor to learn the tools of the trade of defense at that time.
Yeah.
And it was,
and it shows him to be a very brave character
Indeed.
Right from the start.
Indeed, and when it came to target practice and things like that, he was one for the eye on targeting the
sure.
The having a target at the necessary item.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see he's learning a vast range of expertise, which later on proved to be extremely
sure.
essential
mm-hmm.
in his own character building.
Right.
You know, and the fact that whilst he is developing in his studies, you have, if we were to really break Imam Khomeini's life into certain phases,
sure,
we can see that, you know, this is a second major phase of his building.
Yeah.
From the age of, you could say, 6 years old to 1962. A whole wide range of period of learning that Imam Khomeini is going through. For not only just learning, but also teaching.
Yeah.
That's to say, you know, more and more he's experiencing for himself, not really dabbing into any kind of confrontational situation.
I think, of course, you know, we'll do this in a later program, but I think the depth of the mastery of his scholarship and the fact that, as I say, we'll mention in the depth that even the students of Imam Khomeini, I mean, honestly, I mean, at times I'm taken back, drawn back to Imam Jafar as-Sadiq alayhi salam, when, you know, scholars of other traditions used to come and ask him questions, and he would say, well, please don't ask me that question. Please ask my student.
My student
this question. Yeah. Just to see the competency, the mastery of the teaching of what he was disseminating. But as I say, that's a later
but
thing.
But you see, what happened as we look at it in a chronological order?
Yeah, right.
You know, Imam Khomeini in about 1920. That's when the First World War is finished.
And dramatic changes have taken place in the war.
Changes have taken place.
Yeah.
Yet
in the Muslim world,
he's alhamdulillah at a stage where he's expanding his knowledge more.
Right.
You know, his brother Ayatollah Pasandide, who arranges.
Yes,
for
his tutelage was exactly more with his brother, wasn't it?
With
really?
His brother.
Yeah.
And you find that his brother had arranged him to go and study in Isfahan. But instead of going to Isfahan, he's directed towards Iraq. And that
Iraq,
in itself, Iraq. That in itself has been an essential learning process for him.
We'd like to mention for our listener, Iraq is not confused with Iraq, but
it's a central province
of a town very near Qom.
And there, the houses were being run, or there the main house in Iraq was being run by Ayatollah Abdul Karim Hari Yazdi. He was the one who was running that house and very well established house as it was.
Yes, I mean, he was the founding father of the establishment of the Hawza as we know it today in Qom. But of course it came at a price, because the Pahlavis had now come into power, especially with Raza Pahlavi. And of course he was an army man, very brutal, very irreligious. He immediately put in the ban of the veil, which was following from Ataturk's thing, what he was doing with the Ottoman, the decline of the end of the Ottoman Empire. So a lot of things were happening which were very anti-Islam, very anti-Sharia. And of course, you know, there's that horrible story, but it has to be mentioned, that when this Raza Khan came to Qom, the leading authority at that time, one of the Ayatollahs here, was beaten by the Shah. In public, in a manner to try to humiliate him. But of course, the knock-on effect was different, because of course in the public's mind, this brought out the true nature of the beast that the public was facing, especially here in Qom.
And you see, particularly with the fact that Ayatollah Hari Yazdi was a highly respected personality.
Sure, sure.
His hawza, or the management of the hawza in Iraq, had a reputation of its own in training of ulema, that it could not be contested in any way whatsoever.
Right.
And you know, particularly with Imam Khomeini going over there and experiencing at a very young age, a very tender age of 18 years old,
he's
really kind of building his whole process of learning from this environment. That, you know, when Ayatollah Yazdi moved the madrasa, moved the environment of the hawza from Iraq to Qom, which was in 1920 itself, that we see that Imam Khomeini doesn't hesitate in moving over with him.
He
finds that this is an opportunity not to be missed. And really and truly, where a lot of people may think, well, you know, some of our community people think, okay, I've studied 6 years, 7 years, let me go back to my community. No, Imam Khomeini wants to venture further in his
I think this shows something
study.
About even at Imam Khomeini, even as a teenager, he shows great insight, great depth and wisdom in his decision making of where he wants to go and study and what subjects he wants to study, because of course he's taking on the Hawza studies, the traditional Quranic sciences studies, but he's also learning mathematics, he's also learning other subjects as well, which shows a wisdom and an intellect superior perhaps even beyond his contemporaries, that exactly what kind of target, what kind of goals he wants to reach.
You see, but the goals, he keeps those goals under control. That's
true, because he's always against the ego, isn't he?
He's against the ego. But he was of a very important opinion that whoever is the leader of the Shia Ummah at a particular time should be the person responsible to dictate what the political environment should be.
Absolutely.
He did not venture out beyond his limits that
he
identified himself with relation to the leader.
But that shows a great wisdom in there.
Not only just wisdom, but what it shows is the total nature of Shia opinion. If you look at Karbala,
and the divergence is allowed there.
Not only just divergence, the fact that recognition of the Imam of the time. You know, you had Imam Zainul Abidin al-Islam.
That's right, because
ill and everything. Yet still, Hazrat Zainab says, "You're the Imam of the time. What should we do?"
And the other thing is that we have to point out that even Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who was a completely revolutionary character alongside his brother Imam Hassan alayhi salam, but if Imam Hassan alayhi salam stayed quiet during the rule of Bani Umayyah during Muawiyah's 20-year period, Imam Hussein was quiet as
And this is what we're learning from Imam, what Imam Khomeini had learned, that when you identify with the leader of the time or whoever it is, that Ayatollah Hariri may be Ayatollah Hariri, may it be Ayatollah Bujedi at a later time, you do not venture beyond that. You can guide and you can support, but you do not venture behind the authority.
And I think that the support of Imam Khomeini at that particular stage is also very, very important. As you say, it does speak volumes in itself.
Indeed.
But we are going to carry on with that in the next edition of the program, where we will go further into the scholarship of Imam Khomeini, and then later on the works that he starts to come up as an accomplished scholar. And of course, he also achieved his becoming a mujtahid at a very early stage in his life as well. But we'll get on to that at a later program. At this moment in time, my dear audience, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have as well. So thank you for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings of Allah and His mercy be upon you all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life. Keys of life.
Aksel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. The systematic kind of approach that Islam has on how we are able to conduct ourselves, how we are able to not only preserve our lives as human beings and flourish in this world, but also make sure that we are working towards what's going to benefit us in the hereafter, ultimately, but also what's going to give us that kind of sa'ada dunyawiya, this a pleasurable, positive, good, happy life. And what I mean by a systematic kind of approach is that it's catering for all of these different things all at once. And that's what's so unique and so special about our religion, Islam. And Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli makes it very clear in the beginning of chapter 5, where he wants to discuss cleanliness and hygiene. And he says that Islam is based on three foundations. So there are three pivotal kind of centralized elements in Islam. The first is your belief system. The second is your moral system. The third is your legal system. Your aqidah, your aqaid, your belief, your ideological kind of understanding of things, which is based on and centralized on tawheed, is something that will enable you to have the best kind of intellectual, rational lifestyle. And it will keep you away from any kind of pollution, of shirk, of polytheism, or anything else that will, you know, put your rational kind of understanding on hold, or that will remove your aqli capacity to conduct yourself, to live as a human being. And that's why Islam is a reason first religion. So your aql and ta'aql comes first, and then everything else. You know, it's a reason based religion. It's not a faith based religion.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafati, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. there are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.